From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Tomorrow, we celebrate the Chinese New Year. We'll usher in the year of the snake with seven courses of, are you ready? Boa constrictor. Valentine's Day is just a few days away. Learn about edible aphrodisiacs, plus eating hearts, and we're not talking about those little chocolate-covered kinds. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what's fresh and in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's the time of year where chefs are looking for inspiration at the market, as always. And David Lefevre is one of our favorite stalwart regular chefs here at the market every week. He, of course, is the chef at MB Post down in Manhattan Beach. David just spent a day on a farm, one of his favorite farmers, Coastal. And David, you were up there walking the field, looking at the planting. Tell us what you saw and what you're going to be cooking this week.
It was great. You know, Marianne and Mark met me up there just in Santa Paula, and, you know, it's great. They have what's considered a small farm. It's 15 acres, but it was just abundant. They had cavolo nero. They had red and green mustard frill, sprouting broccoli. They had rapini, green and red gem lettuce, troutback lettuce. You know, it's really inspiring to see two people who really care about the earth and are really pulling the bounty of it. And seeing him, you know, Mark and his wife actually pulling out carrots. You know, they have 15 acres. There's four people working 15 acres. It's just really inspiring, you know, and we're already planning a trip to bring the rest of my crew up there. And, you know, we've got cooks that are working from us who've never been outside of downtown LA. So it'll be great to get them out to the farm and to really have them see where the stuff comes from.
So what are you going to be cooking then from the farm?
Well, I think one thing that we really loved was the cavolo nero, you know, Tuscan kale. And it seems like right now kale's really gained a ton of popularity. It's super nutrient rich. It's good for you. It's got great fiber. We're doing a salad right now with quinoa, cooked quinoa, kale that we take and kind of chiffonade to make it a little bit more toothsome. Some of the lettuces that they have, we're adding some roasted beets from there as well. We're just taking them, rubbing with olive oil, salt and pepper, roasting them, peeling them, dicing them, putting them in the salad. And then we're doing some pine nuts and a little bit of goat cheese. And then, you know, instead of doing some super elaborate vinaigrette, we really want to just highlight the vegetables that we're getting. And all we're doing is we're sprinkling about a tablespoon of olive oil on the salad and then just freshly squeezed lemon juice. You know, I mean, citrus, you can get it everywhere right now in Southern California. I mean, you see just all the beautiful citrus that they have here at the market right now.
And so the dressing is enough to just drizzle the two? You don't have to blend them and pour? You just drizzle one, drizzle the other in that order?
You don't need to make it elaborate. You make it very, very simple, and it tastes really fresh and really good. You know, it's fresh lemon juice. You know, you don't want to pre-squeeze it. You want to have it just cut and squeezing your hands right over there. Have the lemon juice drip down your wrist and have it just a great, really fruity olive oil. And it's very simple. You know, it sounds almost too simple, but in the end, when you have the beets and you have the goat cheese and you have some pine nuts in there, it all comes together.
Absolutely. And it's that one bowl wonder. You throw everything in one bowl, fewer dishes to wash. It's perfect.
Exactly.
That was David Lefevre, chef owner of MB Post in Manhattan Beach, telling us how he got inspired by being on the farm. We're visiting now with the actual Carpenter family, talking with Pernella Carpenter. She's Mark Carpenter's wife. And your table today is just glowing with green. I mean, literally, it's just so healthy and vibrant looking. Tell us what's growing now and what kind of greens you're harvesting, and just kind of paint a picture for us, could you?
We've got really nice stuff going on right now. We have a lot of chard, we've got a lot of kale, lettuce, and we've got three different kinds of carrots. And we've got the mustard, the red and the green, which is really good. The red's got a really nice spice to it. It's really good. We've just got a lot of really nice, beautiful stuff right now.
And even with all this cold weather, your chard in particular is absolutely glossy, healthy. The leaves aren't looking all tore up. Do they love cold weather?
They do. It's really nice. The rain has been really good to us, and it's really nice. Big bunches. We're really liking that right now.
And you got the cavolo nero, because David was talking about that, too. So tell us more about the mustard and why this variety. I know there must be at least a dozen different kinds of mustard you could be growing.
This kind of, it's just really beautiful. Two different colors are so vibrant, and it's so pretty. It's nice frill on it, and it's got just that great, great taste. Like I said, the red one's got a nice spice to it.
And so the green is just not hot at all?
It's a little bit more mild. It's not as spicy as the red. The red has just got a really distinct, nice spice to it.
Okay, so hot enough to sort of burn your mouth a little?
No, 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 not at all. It's not that spicy, but you can definitely get the taste of it.
Okay. And how long are you going to have it?
We will be having it for quite some time throughout the spring.
It's beautiful on the plate and a great addition. You can add that, obviously, to other greens if you want to kind of spice up one green or kind of tone this down a little. So
you can do it raw with the salads. It gives it a nice color to it, too. The red is really beautiful in a salad, and you can also cook it, too.
Well, you certainly have the variety on the table. It certainly is inspiring. And thanks so much for all the info.
Thank you.
That was Pernella Carpenter. She's Mark Carpenter's wife and very inspired and proud of these gorgeous greens she's got out here today. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
What's your favorite winter green? Are you a kale addict like me? Or do you prefer mustard greens or chard? Share your winter greens recipes on my Facebook page. Just search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Also, I quickly want to thank everyone who pledged their support during our winter membership drive. A big thanks to everybody who rejoined and to all of you who are first-time members. Welcome to the family. Truly, we couldn't do it without your support. Now, it's time for a visit from Jonathan Gold. Did you know that Jonathan's the only writer to ever win a Pulitzer Prize for food writing? It's true, amazingly enough, and he joins us right here on Good Food every week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, he's revisiting a Los Angeles icon, Spago. Perhaps the most famous LA restaurant closed for several months last summer for a complete makeover. Jonathan joins me in studio now to share his impressions of the new design and the new menu from Chef Wolfgang Puck.
It's been de-kitchified. It's still slightly kitschy, but it's different. So there are not just an Ed Ruscha lithograph on the walls, but a really good Ed Ruscha lithograph. There is a beautiful skylight in the dining room that was never there before. And the patio, that nice patio with the olive trees, has a roof over it now, a retractable roof, but a roof.
But it also gave Wolfgang a chance to take a look at the menu and change it a bit.
Right. If Spago 1.0 was the trattoria, and 2.0 introduced a lot of Chinese ideas, and then when they moved to Beverly Hills, they revisited the Austrian food of, you know, Wolfgang's youth. And this time around, they're playing in the playground of the, I don't know what we call it now, the modernist international restaurant.
So give us an idea of some of the things that maybe we won't find on the menu anymore that were many people's go-to items when they would go to Spago.
I mean, you won't find just plain roast pigeon in a sauce, right? I mean, you won't find the beet salad with goat cheese that everybody went to. They still have a Chino Farm vegetable salad, but it's a different Chino Farm vegetable salad. The prices are slightly lower. They're smaller, and they want you to order four courses. So instead of appetizers, entrees, you have dishes marked 1, 2, and 3.
So it's sort of small plate-esque.
Right. There's a version of chirashi sushi, for example.
Now describe what that is for people.
Chirashi sushi is sort of a beautiful but trashy Japanese sushi lunch dish where instead of having the sushi individually made, you have a bowl of sushi rice with some condiments on it, you know, some wasabi, some usually salmon roe, some other things, then the fish scattered across the top.
Yeah, the sashimi. I love it. So how is he doing it?
His is a beautiful sort of handmade box. It looks like something you get at a kaiseki restaurant. It's really that carefully arranged. And there's a piece of hamachi on it. There's the salmon roe. There's a beautiful thing of sea urchin. There's bluefin tuna, which I totally do not approve of. Please stop using bluefin tuna shifts. Thank you very much. It's endangered.
You're super endangered.
And you eat it like sushi, and it is sushi. It's hard to figure out why are you having this here instead of at Shunjise. But it's very close to the quality you get in like a top level sushi place. And he's obviously getting his fish at the same wholesale houses that the good sushi people are. And he obviously is revered as much by the top sellers as anyone else. So there you have it. You have sushi in a nominally French restaurant.
Interesting. Well, you have to look at his audience, too. People who care about their health, care about their weight, and that's a great dish to eat.
Yeah, and one of the differences between us here in Los Angeles and people in, say, New York is that in New York, when they're going out for a big blowout meal, it'll usually be to one of those Leur La places, right? I mean, you go to Danielle, you go to La Bernardin. And here, if people are splashing out, it tends to be for sushi.
Isn't that funny?
And we're proud of it. There's a really nice thing that looks like as if it would be a bone marrow dish. It looks close to that wonderful bone marrow flan dish that he does at Cut, his steakhouse down the street. But it's capped with a smoked mascarpone that resembles marrow in looks, though not in taste, and is filled with a veal tartare. It's very close to what the Spanish are doing now. The amuse, the little first courses change every day and with who you are and stuff. But sometimes he'll bring out a bonsai tree and there'll be this little thing that looks like an acorn cupped in a little cup. And you pick it up and it's potato that has, truffle and potato and vegetables in it. It's delicious. It's amusing.
What an amuse-bouche should be.
Exactly.
So let's talk about number three. All right. Is number three on the menu sort of the center of the plate course?
Number three is certainly the bigger ones. Number two being more or less a pasta course, though a different kind of pasta course. I mean, you can get a really good version of that giant raviolo with egg and the truffle in it that we've enjoyed at so many restaurants in this country over the years.
And he's always made incredible agnolotti.
Yeah. Stuff with, pumpkins, amaretto, and sage, the classic version, Parmesan on top. But when you're going to the big dishes, it's usually harder to be super creative with a giant protein, But he manages. There's a version of the bass dish at Berasategui in San Sebastian, which in the original and here, the scales have been – they're still on the fish. They've been scraped to sort of a vertical position and then flash fried by pouring really hot oil over the surface of the fish. So it's this crunchy contrast to the soft meatiness of the fish itself. The fish is garnishing itself.
So you're eating the scales that have been deep fried.
You are. And I was knocked out by the dish when I had it in Spain. I was knocked out by the version that they do at Spago. The thing that he has that's different from a place like Muguritz is that Spago has people go there three times a week. They always have. That's probably the bulk of the customer base. And so they have to have steaks. They have to have veal chops with garlic. They have to have something like braised short ribs with horseradish because people aren't going to want to go there for the extreme novelty every single time out of the bat. And what I think is interesting is that they've managed to do that marriage, that they've managed to have a place that you'd want to go back to a lot, but you can also be absolutely dazzled by. And I think the absolutely dazzling thing is something that may have been missing from the last iteration of Spago and that is here now.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about the recently refurbished Spago by famed chef Wolfgang Puck. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget, you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant map, which lives on the Good Food blog. Coming up, find out what to eat to bring you luck and prosperity in the Chinese New Year. Plus, have you ever eaten snake? An intrepid eater embarks on a 7-course dinner where snake is the star of the meal. Stay with us.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When it comes to making Chinese food at home, I have to admit that I've struggled crossing the boundary from rote preparation to intuitive cooking.
the ingredients, the moves. It's always felt so awkward to me. But with Every Grain of Rice, Fuchsia Dunlop's new book, it really feels like I found a mentor to reframe the whole experience for me. I feel so much more comfortable that I'm even taking on preparing a Chinese New Year's dinner. So I've asked Fuchsia Dunlop to lead the way. Hi there.
Hi.
Your new book is so great. I just want to tell you that.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I think from the time I had it in my hand to the time I had it open on the counter cooking from it, maybe one of the shortest lead times I've ever experienced.
That's great.
So first of all, could you start us off by describing what the New Year's celebration is like in China?
Well, the New Year's Eve dinner is the time when the whole family is supposed to get together. And that's why the public transport system all over China grinds to a halt as all the workers all over the country try to get home to their villages or their family homes. The New Year's Eve dinner, it might begin actually with making offerings to ancestors. You know, I stayed with a family in Hunan where we went to the grave of an uncle who died recently and left little dishes of food for him. So you invite your ancestors to join in the feast as well. And then the New Year's Eve dinner, it's just the most lavish meal of the year. You know, in the past, a lot of people in China, particularly rural people, didn't eat much meat during the year. They ate mainly grains and vegetables. But a lot of households still fatten up a pig for the New Year. They kill it in the last month, and then there's lots of meat on the table. There's also perhaps a chicken and, crucially, a fish, because nian yu yu, is a punning phrase, which means a fish every year, but it also sounds the same as a year of plenty or every year plenty.
That's so interesting. So fish has come to symbolize, because of a verbal pun, all the good things that might happen to you in the upcoming year. So what kind of fish are we talking about?
Well, that doesn't really matter. I mean, it's just a whole fish. You know, you don't want to have fish cut into pieces, but a whole fish.
And how is it prepared?
Well, you can do whatever you like, really. With China, the cooking is so very regional, but I would suggest perhaps that a simple steamed fish is a glorious thing to eat, because you see the fish in all its finery. It's easy to make, it's incredibly healthy, and it's utterly delicious.
For some reason, when I think about roasting whole fish, I think, oh, that's just really easy. I'll just throw it on a little baking pan and do what I'm going to do with it and pop it in the oven. But when I think about steaming a whole fish that would feed four people or more, I think about, how am I going to steam that fish? What kind of equipment do I need?
Well, it's very easy, really. I mean, you can have a steamer that fits in your wok, or you can have a steamer saucepan, ideally one that's big enough to put a plate with a whole fish on it. But if you don't have one that big, you can cut it in half and then reassemble it on the serving dish. But if you don't have a steamer, all you need really is a wok and then a trivet. You can get a metal trivet in a Chinese shop, or just lay a couple of chopsticks in the wok and they'll act as a stand for your plate. And you put water in the bottom of the wok, you lay your fish on its plate on your trivet, and then you cover it with a lid. And that's also a very easy way to steam a fish.
Oh, that seems incredibly easy. Now, do we do anything to it first before we start steaming it?
Ideally, make a few slits, diagonal slits, three or four along each side of the body of the fish, and then rub it with a little salt and Shaoxing wine inside and out. And then take a piece of ginger, one spring onion, smack them with the side of your cleaver or rolling pin just to loosen them up, and put them in the belly of the fish and just leave it while you prepare the other ingredients. And this, in Chinese culinary terms, just refines the flavor of the fish and brings out the best of it. And then when you're ready to steam, drain off any juices that may have come out while you're marinating it, and then take a plate and lay on it a couple of spring onions, and this will stop the fish just lying absolutely flat and flush with the plate. Lay the fish on it and just steam it. And the important thing here is just not to overcook it. You want the fish to be just done. So depending on the size, sort of between 8 and 12 minutes. And you can tell if it's done by just poking a chopstick in the thickest part of it, just behind the head. The flesh should flake easily away from the bone. When it's done, drain off any juices that have come out, and you may want to transfer it to another dish, or you can serve it on the plate that you've steamed it in. and then strew over it some very finely slivered spring onions and ginger, and then heat up a little bit of oil, just, you know, a few tablespoons of oil till it's very sizzling hot, and then just drip it over the ginger and spring onion, and there'll be a wonderful sizzling noise and beautiful smell of ginger and spring onion, and it just takes out their fragrances. And then finish off with just spooning over a bit of light soy sauce. And it's funny because this is one of the easiest dishes to make. But whenever I have a dinner party, you know, I might serve it alongside things that I've taken a lot more time and trouble. And this is the one that people always rave about.
You know, one of the things that we found so interesting about your new book is that as we flip through the photos and the recipes, we see so many ingredients that we can find here at local farmers markets, sautéed fava beans, snow peas, romano beans, and even chard. So if we wanted to create a vegetable side dish to celebrate the new year to go along with our fish, what would you choose for us?
Well, one of my favorite dishes in the book is the twice-cooked chards. You know, not the most inspiring, you would think, but cooked in this way, which is to say using the same seasonings as for that classic Sichuanese dish, twice-cooked pork, it's utterly delicious.
Yeah, I think with this kind of cooking of vegetables that we in Southern California are so blessed to have year-round, it's a way of completely changing up the flavor profile of what many of us are used to preparing in our kitchens.
Yeah, and I think in a way the point of this book was to show people that Chinese food can be healthy and sustainable and also really delicious. And that's because the Chinese are just expert at using, you know, little bits of meat, all these very umami-rich fermented seasonings like preserved vegetables, black beans, chili bean paste and soy sauce to give vegetables the sort of exciting, rich taste that we associate with meaty dishes.
When you are referring to black beans, you're not talking about just boiled black beans that we're really familiar with here in Southern California. You're talking about a fermented black bean preparation.
Yeah, salted, fermented black beans. They're kind of like a dry form of soy sauce, and they have that intense, fermented, salty flavor. You can get them in any Chinese grocery store.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And thank you so much for giving us a book that is so adaptable to how we like to cook at home.
Well, thank you very much, and Happy New Year.
Same to you. That was Fuchsia Dunlop. Fuchsia was the first Westerner to train at the Sichuan Institute of Higher Cuisine and has shared her wonderful experience and expertise in both articles and cookbooks. Her new book is Every Grain of Rice. It's a great book. I've already cooked from it. Go check out what I made on the Good Food blog. This year's Chinese New Year's celebration ushers in the Year of the Snake. And our friend, Deep End Diner, Eddie Lin, is celebrating with, well, you guessed it, snake. Seven courses, in fact, of boa constrictor. Chef Lupe Liang, owner of Hop Wu in Chinatown, invited Eddie to a snake feast that he was cooking for his family. Eddie interviewed Lupe over dinner while Lupe's daughter-in-law translated.
Hello, everyone. This is Eddie Lin with Good Food. And I'm here with Chef Lupe Liang of Hop Wu. And we're here today to talk about snake, specifically eating snake. Hey, ni hao, Chef Lupe, ni hao.
Hi, ni hao, Eddie. Hi, ni hao.
Okay, so what I'm going to ask you is snake popular in China and why do people eat it?
Okay.
Chinese has been eating snakes for the last thousands of years. It's in our traditional dishes. Snake is a warming food, which means it warms your body and enhances your blood circulation. It's good for the kidney and good for pretty much everything on your digestive system. Normally, you will use python and rattlesnake. The more poisonous the snake is, the better it is.
So the more poisonous the snake is, the better it is? I don't understand. Really? How is that? 怎么会这样子?
因为这越肚的时候,它这个力度就是越大的。
Okay, actually, I think what he meant is the more powerful the snake is, the better it is. Chef Lupe? Could you tell me some of the popular dishes that are made from snake in China?
The most popular dishes in China is a soup that combines snake, cat, and chicken together. Snake is like a dragon, and cat is like a tiger. Chicken is like the finest. So combine these three together is the most popular dishes in China.
We obviously weren't going to have a snake and cat stew for dinner, but Chef Lupe had prepared a huge feast for me and his family. When I set up the interview, I thought we were just going to fry up some snake meat. But no, this was seven courses of boa constrictor, utilizing every component of the snake, nose to tail, tip to tip. The meal turned out to be much more interesting and more elaborate than I could have imagined. According to Lupe's daughter Mary, it's not uncommon for her father to make elaborate meals out of unusual ingredients.
I think I've been eating a bunch of like weird things ever since like forever. I think like the first thing I can remember was probably something called bird's nest, which is supposed to be the saliva of a swallow bird. I know it's considered, I think, a delicacy, and it's supposed to be like really expensive. And in the beginning, I was like, that's so weird. Like, why am I eating like a bird's saliva, you know? But then they're smart about it because they made it in like a soup, but it was sweet. So it just pretty much tasted like dessert soup or something. Like, I'll try everything once. I've never had a seven-course snake feast either, so this is a experience.
I mean, it's only one snake. It can't be that big of a meal, right?
He said it's a pretty big snake. He told me the other day to not go to the car because he said I might get scared because there's a snake in the car.
You're kidding.
I'm serious.
Oh, my gosh.
He came home, and that was the first thing they said to me, and I just said, okay.
Don't go to the car. You might get totally frightened by the size of the snake. Turns out one boa constrictor creates a lot of snake meat and snake skin. Course one came out, a cold snake skin salad with cucumber, celery, and jellyfish. That is a whole lot of skin. I've never seen a pile of skin like this before. It's really chewy and slippery. You know, you gotta like slimy snake texture. I really like it. I'm serious. It kind of looks cool, too. And to see the designs of the snake, the scaly design. But it doesn't taste, it doesn't feel like scales. You know, it's very smooth. Eating snake, even snake skin, wasn't so bad after all. I figured I could do this for six more courses. No problem. Okay, we're on to dish number two, and it's a big pot of soup. And Chef Lupe just told me that this is actually considered like the main thing to eat because it contains the most nutrients and the most benefits. It contains the snake. It has chicken meat, and it also has pork. And it has all kinds of herbs, medicinal herbs, that complement the yangness of the snake meat. And when we're talking about yang as far as food is concerned, it's really about warming. It's about foods that will balance out your body if it's too cold. If you want to, you know, get rid of your arthritis, it's supposed to help that. Any ailment that is caused by coldness, a yang food is supposed to counteract that. The dishes kept coming out. Next was a platter of little fried nuggets of snake, which tasted, as they say, like chicken. And then came a clay pot stew with a garlicky gravy, meaty shiitake mushrooms, pork, and of course, more snake. When course five came out, I began to learn a lot, maybe too much, about the anatomy of a snake.
So this soup has snake stomach, snake liver, snake intestines, so a lot of snake guts in there. And it also has some kind of, I think it's spinach, and it has a green turnip, and then the daikon, radish or white turnip. This is it's supposed to be a detoxifying soup, as well as help to eliminate excess gas. There you have it. Oh, that was just an intestine we saw. It looked like a strand of noodle with some stripings on it. Interesting.
Oh, man. I've eaten a lot of crazy stuff, but this is up there. This is up there with the craziest. But the crazy part hadn't even started. Enter course number 6.
This is the steamed rice, and there's Chinese sausage on top, and it looks like there's some kind of vegetable that's also steamed. And then in the center is what looks almost like a blood sausage, right? Like a round blood sausage, but it's actually just coagulated blood, coagulated snake blood. It's just a steamed rice with this wheel of boa blood in the center. Wow, I've never seen anything like it.
The texture of coagulated snake blood, because I'm sure you're wondering, is kind of like a steamed egg white. And actually, it was surprisingly bland and tasteless. A bit of a disappointment. But what wasn't bland was course 7, the grand finale, the apex, the pièce de résistance. Chef Lupe brought out a wine glass filled with just a few ounces of murky, dark green liquid. This, he explained, was snake bile. About a shot glass worth of it, and floating at the bottom of the glass of bile was the snake's gallbladder. Into the hot bile, Lupe poured about a cup of Chinese rice liquor, and the color of the liquid changed to a more delicate shade of green. I took a taste.
It's like bitter liquor. Definitely doesn't taste just like liquor. It's like bile. If you've ever had bile come up on you, it's kind of like that. It's kind of like acid, a reflux flavor. It's not a good flavor. Oh my gosh. I'd have to say this drink is bile inducing. Asians have a saying, the more bitter the medicine, the better the medicine. And this, if that's true, this is the best medicine you'll ever have. Oh my. That was a hard one. That last one was a hard one.
In China, this final dish is the most important. In fact, if you eat courses 1 through 6 and you aren't served this final delicacy of snake bile and liquor, you don't have to pay for your meal. It is the point of the whole feast. And according to my hosts, it will keep men virile, warm your blood, and, as an added bonus, keep mosquitoes at bay. So I managed to choke it down, and we toasted to the new year.
All right, happy new year, everyone. 新年快乐,大家新年快乐, 恭喜发财. And for KCRW's Good Food, this is Eddie Lin.
See photos of the 7-course snake dinner on the Good Food blog, and find more of Eddie's intrepid eating adventures at his blog, deependdining.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, it's all about Valentine's Day. A rundown of heart-shaped goodies at the 99-cent store, and a sex therapist shares some edible aphrodisiacs. We'll be right back.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Now, let's head back to the Santa Monica Market for just a minute. Not to the farmer's market. Instead, let's go to the mini market. Independent producer Gideon Brawl returns this week with another mini market report. This time, it's the Valentine's Day edition.
This is Gideon Brower with the mini market report, a look at what's fresh and in season this week at Santa Monica's convenience stores. Valentine's Day is coming up fast. Luckily, there is still time to show the special people in your life just how much you care about them with a visit to your local mini market or discount store.
My name is Erasmo Linares. I'm an assistant manager.
I'm here with you at the 99-cent only store on Lincoln Boulevard, just north of Rose. Is that right?
That's correct. Lincoln and Rose.
You got a whole aisle here full of Valentine's Day products. What are some of the things you've got here?
We have chocolate candy, hearts, cookies, lollipops, things for cooking, you know, for the kitchen, for baking. We have kitchen towels. We have pot holders.
So you got kitchen towels and pot holders with little hearts on them?
Tablecloths, plastic champagne flutes for the
for the wine or for whatever you...
It has a big pink heart attached to it, the champagne flute.
Exactly. It's a two-pack for 99.99 cents.
Oh, that's a good deal.
So nothing over 99.99 on these Valentine's items. We have the chocolate roses.
Have you had one of those?
Yes, I did. Tastes very good. We have flower bases. We have we have whipped cream. The deli section. So
now, what do you think someone would use a whipped cream for on Valentine's Day?
Yeah, to have it with the strawberries, you know.
I see.
So, that's what it is for. Well, and you can use as you want, but that's usually that we use for strawberries.
For more Valentine's Day gift advice, we turn to Annabella Brito at the Extra Mile Mini Mart at the Chevron gas station on Pico at 14th Street.
The chocolates.
Are those good chocolates?
Yes, I like it. I used to eat them in Europe. You know, you can give anything to the person as long as the person likes it, you know. It can be a Gatorade, a monster drink, a sandwich.
Could you imagine getting a sandwich as a romantic gift?
Why not?
We got some more Valentine's Day food suggestions from Elizabeth Flores at another 99-cent only store at Pico Boulevard and Stewart Street in Santa Monica.
What's in now is the cake pop.
Uh-huh.
A lollipop made of cake. We also have a stand for that.
So it's got little holes in it. So if you make a lollipop made of cake, you can stand them up in a ring around this big heart. Is that right?
Yeah.
What should people do if they don't have a Valentine?
You know what? They can make their own night. We have DVDs. We have microwavable popcorn. We have sodas. You know, you don't have to spend it with somebody. Spend it by yourself with the one you love.
If you love yourself.
Yes, exactly.
Finally, if you're looking for something to go with your chocolate roses and cake pops this Valentine's Day, you might want to talk to Nancy at the USA gas station at Lincoln and Ocean Park Boulevards.
We have the handmade furry animals. They're little cats. They look like they're sleeping. And they meow, too.
For the Mini Market Report, I'm Gideon Brower.
See photos of Gideon's Mini Market finds on the Good Food blog. Sex and food. It's hard to deny the relationship between two of our favorite activities. Linda DeVillers is a psychologist who teaches human sexuality at Santa Monica College, Chaffey College, and Pepperdine. She's also a sex therapist, and her book is Simple Sexy Food. Hi, Linda.
Hi there.
So let's talk about the intersection of these two activities, food and sex. I've always felt like on Valentine's, so much of the activity centers around going to a restaurant, having a really big fancy meal, which is great, especially if you're in the restaurant business, like I was for many years. But as a participant in the romance of the evening, I've often thought, why would you want to stuff yourself before an anticipated evening of intense exercise?
Evan, I truly share your perspective here. I think it isn't sexy to eat a heavy meal, and I think the opportunity for what I sometimes call intermezzo moments is rather lacking in a restaurant. It would be a lot sexier, in my opinion, to be having that romantic meal at home where you're more relaxed. You can probably be more creative about what you wear, about the setting. Are you really going to eat on the table or are you possibly going to eat on the floor?
I love that, eating on the floor. So talk to me about these intermezzo moments.
Well, intermezzo moments for me are putting something on the stove to simmer, and then maybe it takes 45 minutes and you have a little cocktail half hour. It's sensual moments, not just the full-blast erotic moments that I think you can have throughout a meal.
Why do you think certain foods have, for centuries really, been presented to us as aphrodisiacs? And why does it always center on the man's virility?
In a sexist world, it's going to focus on a man's world, unfortunately. Although there are some aphrodisiac foods that actually were focused on women and not men. People look at oysters and they think, well, oysters can be viewed masculine or feminine. And the same thing could be said for things like honey, although the Kama Sutra promoted it for men. But there's something very soft and fluid that I think evokes female imagery when we think of something like honey.
I've also noticed, and your cover is a great example of that, the cover of Simple Sexy Food, red seems to be a theme. Has color always been viewed as part of the erotic experience?
Sometimes color is part of that erotic experience. And red, it's very interesting you mention that. Because, yes, lobsters are red and evoke vitality, etc. But things like tomatoes and beets, in the Middle Ages particularly, were feared. Red was considered a very dangerous color.
So talk to me just a little bit more about this intersection between food and eroticism and sex.
They're both basic life-enhancing experiences. I think when one has a wonderful meal, one has a sense of desire, one has a sense of satisfaction, and even satiety, we could say. And the same thing happens with good sex, that you have that sense of longing and yearning and ultimate satisfaction.
Oh, that's really true, you know, in an ideal world.
Yes, in an ideal world. And you know, that's the other point. It's how you approach food and sex that makes so much of a difference. We live in a fast food world right now. We may be living in a fast sex world as well. The cell phone is on. I've got to get work done. And so I think part of the philosophy here is to slow down, savor, and truly experience the moment deeply.
You mentioned fast food. As a sex therapist, have you noticed that fast food decreases libido? Do you talk to your patients about how eating habits?
Yes, I do. I truly believe that what I call lifestyle habits, which includes both food and exercise, significantly impact the quality of a person's sex life. And if you're eating fast food, which is usually high fat, heavy, high cholesterol type foods, you are clogging your arteries. Good sex and clogged arteries do not mix.
Linda, take me through what would be your sort of ideal late afternoon evening of romantic food.
All right. I will share with you some of my personal favorites. And I think it's important for people to recognize that what makes a food aphrodisiac is not just totally inherent in the food, but what you think of it, how you perceive of it, and if you like it. If you don't like it, this is not the right food.
Like you shouldn't be choking down raw oysters.
Exactly. If oysters aren't your thing, pick something else. There's a whole panoply of things to pick. So for me, I happen to like something called bagna coda. It translates hot bath. It's Italian. And it involves an elixir of garlic, oil, butter, and a secret ingredient I won't mention.
Anchovies.
Yes.
I mentioned it.
But if it's all mixed up together, you don't realize what it is. And I find lots of people like it. I love it. And then you get your favorite veggies, most of which have aphrodisiac reputations anyway, and you dip them into this elixir, and you use French bread to capture drippings, and when it's dripped enough, you can eat the bread as well. It's light, it's refreshing, you can readily eat this on the floor, however you want to do it, and you can feed it to your partner, or you can feed it to yourself. I just think it's fun.
Thank you so much, Linda.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was Linda DeVillers. She's a psychologist and sex therapist here in LA. Her new book is Simple Sexy Food. Find her recipe for bagna coda on the Good Food blog. Continuing our Valentine's Day theme, let's talk about hearts. There are chocolate hearts and those little candy hearts that read things like, "You're cute," or "Be mine." But what we don't usually see are actual hearts, you know, beef hearts, lamb hearts, chicken hearts. That is, unless you're attending a Valentine's Day dinner cooked by Chef C.J. Jacobson. You might know C.J. from his stints on Top Chef, but we here at Good Food have known him for years as a fixture at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. C.J. will be the guest chef at This Is Not a Pop-Up in East Hollywood later this week. Hi, C.J.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
Good. So let's talk about heart, because it's such an amazing taste experience, but most people have never gone there. What is the texture like of most hearts?
The texture of heart is, it's a little bit firmer, so it is sort of fun to cut in a tartare because you're not having like some any sort of like tenderloin or anything like that. And it's maroon in color, maroon to dark, dark red. There's some silver skin and some fat around it. And the fat itself, a lot of people just discard, but you can cube that also really, really well. And that can kind of sort of adjust to sort of, I don't know, gaminess or kidney-like sort of flavor that sort of a heart has. But it's very, very lean, and it's very, very beef-flavored.
They're huge. Organy.
They're humongous. They're kind of frightening at first, even to any chef when you, like, if you're first sort of, you know, tackling one of these guys, it's a little terrifying.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated by heart because the fibers are so dense. I mean, if you think about it, in all of we mammals, it's the hardest working muscle there is. And so it has these really, really compact muscle fibers. So when you cut it, the texture is, how would you characterize it? Just, it's smooth.
Yeah, it's very, very smooth. It's actually a really enjoyable piece of meat to cut. And another thing with butchering the heart, it's really not that frightening because it's sort of like one of those pieces of meat where everything makes sense. Like, I don't want to eat these long stringy things or these tube-like things. A lot of hearts now that you get, like, from purveyors, they won't have any of the tubes or anything like that. So they're kind of easy to butterfly. When you butterfly them, you have, like, one sort of large piece, then it kind of, like, evens out. So one-third large, then two-thirds sort of medium large.
I know that there's the Peruvian style of serving it like anticucho style, where you cut it into really small cubes and grill it.
Yeah.
Do you like doing that?
I love doing that. And, I mean, you can do it a lot of different ways. You know, if you have access to a sous vide, you can, you know, kind of confit it with a little bit of fat. And you can even use its own fat that's kind of packed in around because it's really, really, it melts really well. But, again, just taking the meat also as if you would if it was like a hanger steak. It's kind of like the same texture. And just charring it like that and slicing it and helping out the person who's going to eat it by actually slicing it, it's delicious. I know Pica does that. It's like one of my favorite dishes there.
Yeah, really wonderful. I love the way Ricardo does heart. What's the flavor like of a beef heart?
The flavor of beef heart is richly, richly, richly beef flavor. I mean, if more people knew this, hearts wouldn't be so cheap. There's so many double entendres here. Cheap hearts. It's super beefy with a little bit of gaminess. Not all that much, though.
I've always thought that beef heart really should be the intro organ meat because in a way it's much more approachable and accessible than other parts of the innards.
Right. I feel the same way. I think it's sort of like tongue and heart are like the gateway drug to like offal.
So we've been talking about beef heart, but let's talk about some of the other hearts. What about lamb's hearts?
Lamb's heart is very similar. It also sort of has like that nickel smell a little bit to it, you know, along with the fell that sort of accompanies lamb.
What is fell?
Fell is a hard thing to explain other than like it's what lamb smells like and gamey things smell like. It's not a smell unless you know what it is. Like if you're breaking down a lamb, well, it smells like fell. Or if you're raised, you know, if you're cooking mutton for a long time, that's what fell smells like. But it's also sort of like a gamey characteristic which you see in a lot of different animals.
You know what I've never tasted? I've never tasted a pig heart. Have you ever tasted a pig heart?
I've never had pig heart either.
I wonder why.
But I love duck hearts, and I love chicken hearts.
Oh, me too.
They're so easy to cook. Everyone out there, go to Mitsu and buy chicken and duck hearts.
So what do you like to do with them?
When I was at NoMa, we were working in the test kitchen, and we were working on a halibut dish. We didn't have anything that was served with red wine in the entire menu, and we had to have something that we could pair red wine with. So we were playing around with turbot, and we wanted something really, really rich, so we had a sauce of duck heart and brown butter, and it was delicious. It didn't get on the menu, but I remembered it, and I will definitely try to use it.
Were the hearts poached in the brown butter? How did you do it?
No, we just trimmed them and sliced them in two pieces and then just seared them so they were rare.
It never occurred to me to go and buy a whole mess of hearts.
Right. They have them at like many Japanese markets, Asian markets, everywhere, and they're usually like, you know, $3 a pound. And a pound of hearts is a lot of hearts.
So what is the Asian preparation of heart? Are they deep fried?
No, I've had them mostly grilled, like izakaya places. I have them on skewers and grilled.
Yum.
Exactly.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've been talking to Chef C.J. Jacobson about heart, beef, lamb, and chicken hearts, to be exact. We'll have a recipe from C.J. on our blog, and you could find C.J.'s heartfelt dinner menu at This Is Not a Pop-Up this Thursday through Sunday. Plus, you can also find him at the Mercantile on Sunset Boulevard. Get more details at kcrw.com/goodfood. Next up, wine. how not to be intimidated, and just, you know, enjoy it. That's in 30 seconds right here on Good Food.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. Let's take a minute to talk about wine now. When you're at dinner and the sommelier arrives to taste the bottle for your table, what do you do? Do you twirl the glass, sniff carefully, quaff down a big gulp, or just take a little sip? Or perhaps, like many thousands of people, you find yourself filled with a sense of dread and total inadequacy because you just don't know what to do. Eric Asimov, chief wine critic for the New York Times, recognizes the anxiety that's stirred in many of us by wine culture. In his latest book, How to Love Wine, A Memoir and Manifesto, he guides us to making wine accessible and non-threatening.
It's more a question of how we talk about wine and how we think about wine, how we educate people in this about wine in this country. Many people find it doesn't really correlate with the way they experience wine at home. And because of this sort of dislocation, they tend to blame themselves as not possessing the proper equipment or talent to simply appreciate wine.
You don't really need to be a connoisseur to just enjoy drinking wine, do you?
Not at all. You know, even the greatest wines have to perform on a very basic level of simply being refreshing and satisfying. And I think, you know, our culture conveys the message that you have to know everything about wine before you can experience this simple pleasure. Take a class, read a book, don't make a mistake, God forbid. And I think it's a backwards formulation. We tend to ignore the fact that all you really need is a simple emotional attachment to wine. You fall in love with it like you would any other thing that fascinates you. And then you're ready just to enjoy the pleasure unimpeded. If you want to plunge deeper, there's a lot of other things you can do, but you don't need to do that first. Even consumer publications like the Wine Spectator are constantly kind of digging through the medical journals to find proof that wine is good for us. To take it as simply something enjoyable, it would show a failure of our discipline, I guess.
So speaking of Spectator, how much attention should we pay to wine scores?
I completely sympathize with people who rely on them. I mean, it's easy to see you walk into a wine shop and there's hundreds of bottles there and you have no idea which one to pick. And the scores are an easy crutch. But I think in the long run, they're counterproductive because they put all wines, whatever their purpose, wherever they're made, onto one very rigid scale, and they completely ignore the importance of context, which may be the most important thing in how we experience wine. The bottle that gets the higher score may be a more tannic, more wine that needs age, and if you take that home rather than the lower scoring bottle and have it with your Tuesday night meatloaf or whatever, you may find that it doesn't work out that well.
I find it really interesting that at least here in Southern California, there's been sort of a new crop of wine shops that have sprung up, and they seem very much geared towards different kinds of people, so that when you go into a shop, if you can be in synchronicity with a shop, they will actually speak your language, and it makes a huge difference.
I think this is one of the greatest things, and I see it not only in Southern California, in New York, all over where I travel. You have all of these new wine shops springing up that are very community-oriented, and they remind me of the independent record shops when I was a kid, or independent bookstores nowadays that really form a sort of a wine counterculture. if you can find a shop where you have a where you feel kind of simpatico with a merchant, or at least can talk to somebody there and develop a personal relationship, I think it's very easy to get a sense of your own taste over time.
You know, people are constantly talking about wine pricing, and I think that's another thing that is intimidating to people. People think that if they like a wine that doesn't cost a lot, there's something wrong with them, and conversely, that they should constantly aspire to have a palate that will appreciate a very expensive wine.
If you can afford to spend $15 to $20 a bottle, that's really the sweet spot for great value. You can find palatable, sound wines at $10 and less, but the real excitement comes when you're spending just a little bit more. Once you get past $20 or $25, it's also a kind of a stylistic crapshoot. A lot of more expensive wines are expensive for a reason, because of high demand or just high labor costs and very difficult to farm places. But there's also the kind of luxury tax that producers put on it themselves, because they know that some consumers just assume it's going to be better if they pay more.
Eric, thank you so much.
Evan, it's been my pleasure.
That was Eric Asimov. He's the chief wine writer for the New York Times, and his new book is How to Love Wine, a Memoir and a Manifesto. Here an outtake from our conversation about his current favorite wine regions on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry, as well as other apps like Stitcher and Downcast. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Sarah Rogozin are our segment producers. Harriet Ells is our executive producer. Big thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleinman. Join me back here next week for another edition of Good Food.